Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. Well, the back and forth continues between Major League Baseball and the Players Association. Jeff Passan's reporting that Major League Baseball is mulling a shorter season with full prorated salaries for players. So in other words, Major League Baseball is saying, you don't like the reduced salaries with more games and we'll just have fewer games. It's a remarkable series of events that are taking place. It's not really negotiations at this point. According to Jeff, though, Major League Baseball does not intend to propose this to the players. The possibility of implementing a schedule of around 50 games that would start in July has been considered by the league as a last resort in the event the parties can't come to a deal. The players have held out for a full prorated portion of their salaries based on a March 26 agreement with the league, and in an offer Sunday proposed a 114-game schedule that would cover 70.3% of their originalist salaries. Major League Baseball, with a 50-game schedule, would cover 30% of that number. So a huge gap there. Some other notes, the Washington Nationals changed course and told their minor leaguers on Monday they will receive their full weekly stipends of $400 through June after reliever Sean Doolittle tweeted that the team's major league players would cover a planned cut in those payments. And Major League Baseball players continue to voice outrage on social media over George Floyd's death. We heard the other day from Pete Alonso. We've also heard from Mookie Betts and Giancarlo Stanton and Andrew McCutchen. Now, before we get to Eduardo Perez, ESPN baseball analyst who's doing KBO games and also has a lot of perspective on this back and forth between the union and Major League Baseball, and we talked to John Shea, the author of a new book about Willie Mays. Today on ESPN Daily, hear the latest in the story of Major League Baseball's return. Jeff Passan breaks down Major League Baseball and player negotiations, plus the fate of the minor leagues. That's ESPN Daily. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Eduardo Perez is a baseball analyst for ESPN. And what that means these days, Eduardo is getting up really early to do KBO broadcast from home, of course, of the league in South Korea. How are you handling all this, this sort of the shakeup of your schedule?
Straight Buster time. That's all I know. I think I'm finally beating you to the wake-up call. It's a 3:30. It's a 3:30 with three snoozes. By the time I get up, it's 3:51. I have a 7-minute snooze instead of a 9-minute snooze going in. So I know by 3:51, I get up, get in the shower. By 4:05, I am already turning on the system, making sure that everything's connected. And then by four, I have everything down. Let's put it this way. I make tremendous breakfast before the games, and it's part of my pride and joy and routine to get ready for the game.
I see the whole snooze button thing I've never understood. Like I'm like, and I think maybe it's because when I was growing up on the farm, the way I was woken up was my dad, we had a heat duct from the first floor to the second floor, and he would stand underneath the heat duct at 4:45, and I just hear this, Buster!
And, you better get up.
And you better get up right at that time. And so, you know, when I went away to school and classmates had, the snooze button, I'd be like, well, what is that about? Just get up on the first one. What's that about, Eduardo?
I think it's more of a game with me. There have been a couple times that I've gotten up before the alarm has even rung. So I'm like, okay, that's good. But I kind of struggle a bit, and I won't lie to you. When I go to sleep around 12:30 and then I need to wake up at 3:30, it's a three snooze and you're out. And then there's a 7 o'clock alarm that my wife has that's on the Alexa that tells me that how good I am, just as a positive vibe, just in case I did miss out on those three snoozes. Just in case.
And I know that the breakfast that you make has the strongest coffee in the world.
I don't drink. I'm not drinking coffee.
What?
I'm not drinking coffee, Buster. That's crazy. I know. It was taken away from me. I have a glaucoma and everything. So the more coffee I drink, the more eye pressure I get. So the doctor took it away from me. And this is pure adrenaline that I go on, believe it or not.
Man, I remember when I went down to Puerto Rico for a couple of stories, and you and I were sort of talking about, because I would grab bags of coffee I got down there. And you were like, yeah, the coffee's so great and it's so strong. Oh, man.
I miss it. Tell me about it. I miss it. But it's okay because I'm waking up to do baseball games. So I look around and I see the world we're in right now. And there's no high school baseball. There's no professional baseball at any level. There's no college baseball. So I looked out and I was like, I just realized that at 5:30 in the morning, I can guarantee you I'm the only baseball analyst working. So it's kind of fun.
Well, you're doing a great job with it. You're doing a great job with it. And I can tell, you know, how much you're energized by getting to watch baseball, because there is no baseball going on here. The two sides are talking about an agreement, talking about getting baseball restarted. But Eduardo, even though we're hearing about offers being exchanged, it feels like there's no negotiation going on, that it's each side restating its position in different ways. And it's sort of like, well, okay, you don't like this proposal. We're just going to reshape it, move the numbers around a little bit, and we'll throw it back at you. But there still doesn't seem to be any real collaboration going on in the middle ground. What do you think?
No, you know what's interesting is that the league's first proposal to the union offered an 82-game schedule, right? You know, with significant salary cuts. We know that, you know. And a lot of multiple players had told ESPN, they had told us about, you know, that they wouldn't abide to the shorter schedule at all. And with one actually even saying that we want to play more games and, you know, we want more baseball. So they go out, they propose 114 game schedule. Major League Baseball comes back with 50, less than that. But then, I don't know about you, but Mr. Quintana and Mrs. Morales, my two math teachers in high school, taught me well. And the average of that is 82. So we go right back to 82.
Yep.
And now I'm thinking, okay, so the days, I think we'll work back to maybe that number, but it's about the salary cut, how the pay scale is going to be set. It's we've known all along it's about the money. We've already taken care of the time early on, players getting their time, but now it's about the compensation factor of it all. And that's going to be the painful one. But at the end of the day, Buster, I really believe until there is a hard set date where we can say by June 10th, or if it's June 15th, we need to have a deal done. If not, no baseball, a deal will get done. And I'm a guy of a glass half full. I was in 1994 as a player. Unfortunately, we did not have a World Series that year. We had replacement players come out in spring training. I'm hoping this year, this time, because of the situation that our country is in, that the world is in, that we get baseball back on the field, Major League Baseball. And I believe that the players and the owners want what the fans want, and that's to see the players on the field.
You're 100% right in your read about when. It's almost like baseball was like, okay, you know, when they initially talked about doing the 50-50 revenue split, and that idea was leaked out there, wasn't formally proposed, but we initially heard back from the union, that's not acceptable. And so then they made that proposal, as you said last week, with severe cuts for the highest paid players over 82 games. And the players rejected that, you know, and gave the long schedule. And now for the third time, it feels like the owners are saying, okay, here's the lump of cash that we have available. You can do it over 50 games. You can do it over 82 games. You can do 50-50 revenue split, but here's the lump of cash that we're willing to split.
Yeah, and again, I think it's going to come down to a happy medium with deferrals that will satisfy the Players Association. And the reason I say that is because when the Players Association came out with their counter and they mentioned the deferrals with no interest, I think at the end of the day, I think it's going to come down to them being able to settle one way. Look, Buster, the reality is there's not going to be any winners here. Okay.
Exactly.
We've lost already games. We've lost. We don't need to lose the fans, the people that are passionate about the game. The beauty of it is that we as ESPN are being able to televise KBO games, not only to the United States and Canada, but we're talking about the entire world, from South America all the way down to Argentina and South America to Europe. I get tweets from people in Spain. I get tweets from people in the Pacific Rim. I get tweets from people, in Brazil. We're being televised around the world. People want baseball. It's a game that is now, so international that we need to be able to provide that to the fans. And when we get baseball, when we get Major League Baseball back, and I love the part where the association said, you know, and players being willing, and the association being willing to have the players accessible during the games. I think it's something that we know that's what people want, to get to know the players a little bit better. The players want to get back. They understand their livelihood, is not that long when it comes to the game. So they want to be able to capitalize as much as they can with it. And, again, we all know that this is an argument of millionaires versus billionaires and billionaires versus millionaires. But the billionaires, they're going to own their teams for a long time. And that's the argument that the Players Association have, with, Major League Baseball and their owners.
Eduardo, how have you felt about the public nature of this discussion? Because it's made me cringe the whole time. And I still, to this day, don't understand why this had to be dripped out into the public or specific statements made by specific people. I really wish that they had kept this under wraps. How'd you feel?
It's so difficult in this world to be able to keep it under wraps. You have so many eyes and ears. Everybody's starving for the information. We're a society right now that we need to have that information ASAP. If it's via Twitter, via Instagram, via Snapchat, whatever it may be, the social media aspect of it makes everyone a breaking news reporter. And the respect that you came up with growing up as a writing and being able to cover teams and saying, okay, this is off the record. That doesn't really exist that much anymore. And that's the part that has really put a stronghold on it. And if you realize it, Major League Baseball and the union, they've learned to be able to use the media probably to an advantage as far as public perception. And we saw the first round actually not even be delivered. It was done by the social media aspect of it. Tony Clark had no idea when he was going to get, if it was a proposal, when or where. He found out through social media. That just tells you the power that goes on right now, via all these magnets. And again, I think it's something that we have to get ourselves accustomed to. At the end of the day, we have to set the egos aside. We have to look and see what's important. And the thing that's important right now is that the fans get their game back, and that we're able to have discussions and in the barbershops and shop and anywhere else about who's a better player, what's a better team, what did you see that play last night, and just argue about baseball and about sports in general. And it's time to bring America's pastime back, but players understand that it's going to come at a cost, but they're not trying to make it so deep into their pockets that it really hurts them twofold in the long run.
Eduardo, I've been absolutely shocked as well about the fact that there hasn't been more collaboration, that there haven't been committees to talk about between players and management. Hey, let's talk about health issues. Let's talk about, you know, how trades would work out. Let's talk about the financial issues. Let's have conversations. As I said yesterday, it feels like that, you know, they're still at the 1 yard line on a 100 yard negotiation, in terms of how much actual collaboration is going on. And part of my worry is that, you know, this is only going to be a precursor of labor stuff to come if there's not collaboration this year. In other words, let's say that the players, mm-hmm. Get something close to what they want, 82 games. Let's say they get 80%. The fact that they really haven't worked together, I'm concerned that next year you know, with the CBA scheduled to expire in December 2021, that, the specter of a strike might be out there. And on the owner's side, the idea that, you know what, we couldn't work with you guys last year. We're coming for your lunch money this year. I just don't like the tone of the discussions because they're not really working things out.
Yeah, they're not. And I think the collaboration comes down to one word, and it's trust. I just don't see a lot of trust when it comes to between both parties. I think there's a lot of skepticism. We've seen it. We've heard it. If it's from Max Scherzer, the comment that he made a few days ago, the veteran guys are the ones that are going to be leading this. It's not the young guys. They're watching. They're learning from this. It's to be a really interesting time in Major League Baseball. This is unprecedented with the pandemic that we had. We already knew it was going to be a battle for the collective bargaining agreement on 12/1/21. That's December 1st. So I just think right now it comes down to, and I said it earlier, setting those egos aside and knowing that this pandemic hopefully will lead to a resolution way before that deadline holds near. But right now we have to focus and on what we can do here and work together and be able to trust that the right thing is going to be done. One thing that stood out to me, Buster, and when I read it, and I read it on Jeff Passan's article and stuff, is the language of the March agreement appears to give the commissioner, Rob Manfred, the right to deliver a season schedule after quote unquote good faith discussions between the league and the union. I just hope the right thing is done amongst both parties. I want the players to play, but I want them to be safe. I want the fans to go, but I want them to be safe. But then again, I want the right call to be made. And in this case, it has to be made. The call, it's going to be a heavy one, but it has to be made on all of their behalfs. And as soon as we saw this pandemic also hitting children hard, I think the Players Association took a step back. They took a step back and said, a lot of us are first-time parents. A lot of us have kids with underlying conditions. We have to be smart about this. The players have to respect what's going on and realize that this is so much bigger than just the game itself. So they have to respect that when we have to stay in as a team in hotels, then let's stay in. Let's get along with each other. Let's be with each other. But let's stay in and not try to bring outside, any outside influence to endanger any of the players and their families.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge. And I'm also, I am worried about that the splinter nature of sort of how this is coming together, that there are going to be, and I've heard this from agents, there are going to be players who, for various reasons, basically decide, you know what, I'm not going to do that. We heard last week that great interview that Carlos Carrasco did with Pedro Gomez, where he has, clearly having been treated for leukemia last year, he has underlying health issue. And that's 100% legitimate concern. I've heard from agents that they worry that, as Blake Snell said, the question is, is it worth it in the face of risk? That you might have some players who just decide, I'm not in this year. And we could have a number of players simply choosing not to participate. Do you share that or do you disagree?
It could happen. I mean, this is much bigger than the game. Yeah. This is your life. And Carlos has a beautiful family also to take care of. And, he wants to be able to share those moments. And he has passions that are also outside the game. I mean, these are men that just happen to be good at their craft, happen to be great at their craft, to be playing at a high level. But they also understand the value that they do this for, and it's for family. It's not, not just the wife and children. It's for your parents. It's for your grandparents. It's who and how you represent yourself. And that's why, looking, if it's at the 114-page document that was written up, that lies in there also. They're going to leave it up to the players to make the right decision on their behalf. Now, there's nothing that is guaranteed in life. And we just have to be sure and make sure that we take care of each other. There are rules that are put out there. No spitting, no this, no that. Buster, I broadcast KBO games, 3 times a week. Pitchers go to their mouth all the time. They wipe their face all the time. Things they aren't supposed to be doing. Yet they still continue to do it. High fives are still going on. Hugs are still going on where they're saying, keep your distance when it comes to the players. Yet they get tested once they go in and once they come out. They know that if one guy tests positive, they shut down the entire league. It's not you go for 2 weeks quarantine. The league is shut down. So we are emotionally ready for that at any moment. Yet we're hoping that it does not happen. And at least those players are keeping their distance outside the field and trusting each other. Again, it comes down to the word of trust, not only with the association, Major League Baseball, but amongst each other and their peers.
Before we go, Eduardo, tell me a player that you have fallen in love with watching the KBO.
Wow, there's a few, man. There's a few. why do you do that to me? You know, I'll tell you this as for foreign players, Roberto Ramos.
Okay.
I am a big fan of Roberto Ramos. I want him to kick butt over there and I want him to come back to Major League Baseball and kick butt here because he is on an agenda. He believed that he should have been with the Colorado Rockies, got him called up after 2 consecutive seasons over 30 home runs and did not even get a call up. They said that he couldn't hit the fastball, that he couldn't hit left-handed pitching. So far, 10 home runs on the season over there. Preston Tucker having a phenomenal start to the season also. Dejo Lee, we know him from the Seattle Mariners, hit a home run. I just love the confidence and the veteran aspect of the whole thing. But Sam Bumna is a name that we have to get to know because I think he'll be the next guy posted from Korea. And once Sam Bumna gets posted, my goodness, this guy for the Dinos can really play. He's represented by Scott Boris, came from a knee injury. It's going to be interesting to see him. But Minwoo Park is my guy. He makes contact, drives the ball, leadoff hitter, second baseman. Really like the guy a lot.
Who's got the best bat flip?
They all do, man. Any home run that they hit, they all do. They all do. You know what there is? There's a lot of flash in the league, man. That's one thing that I've noticed a lot of, Buster. There's a lot of style, a lot of flash. There's a veteran guy that played for Doosan for 6 years, and now he's with the Samsung Lions. Third baseman Won Suk Lee. He has a serious bat flip. He's got a serious bat flip. I like his.
You know what I love, Eduardo? They just seem to have a blast playing. When I've watched, everyone's always having fun. There's always, you know, smiles and everyone's enjoying the heck out of it.
They
just seem to have an absolute blast playing. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, one really cool thing is because Matt Williams is managing the Kia Tigers, I talk to him often. And I love it because I can call him at 11 o'clock at night before I go to sleep. And I'm like, hey, Maddie, tell me about what's going on in your team. And he's like so pumped to talk to you. It's 12 in the afternoon. He's about to have some lunch. Gives me the whole rundown of what goes on. And, you know, so it's actually pretty cool to have contact with all the players. And you can call them late. And my wife at the beginning used to ask me, who are you talking to at this time? And I'm like, Jared from State Farm.
So
I got a lot of Jareds from State Farm over there in Korea that I talk to late at night.
That's awesome. Eduardo, thanks for doing this. Thanks for jumping in.
You got it, Buster.
John Shea is the author of the new book, 24, Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid, of course, about Willie Mays. The foreword of the book was written by Bob Costas. John Shea is, of course, a longtime writer from the San Francisco Chronicle. I've known him for years. John, thanks for joining us. Congratulations on the book.
Well, thank you, Buster. Great to be here.
All right, so one of my things, because I don't know Willie Mays, obviously, in the way that you do, but when I heard that you were doing this project, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool, because I, you know, I always heard that Willie Mays sometimes, you know, not necessarily approachable for writers, but you obviously started up a conversation about this. How did it come about?
Well, I started covering the Giants in 1988, and he was always a clubhouse presence. And you don't see many players who are in the Hall of Fame who hang out in the clubhouse as much as Willie Mays does. Of course, in 1993, Peter McGowan signed him to a lifetime contract, and he's really honored that. He makes himself accessible to everybody. And it's a wonderful thing, whether it's fans or media or players or managers or staff. And I just wrote about him a lot. Who wouldn't, right? As the national baseball writer at the Chronicle in San Francisco. And he trusted me because I kept writing about him more and more. And 15 years ago, I asked him about a book project. And Willie said, well, I'd like to see this book in classrooms. And from there, we went all inspirationally themed and broke it down into 24 chapters and go back to his life, go back to his career. And it's been an exemplary life, by the way. And pretty much everyone I talk to, it's rare that you write a book. And it's not like I tried this, but in retrospect, I'm looking back. Everyone has a Willie Mays story. You know, you put down 200 phone calls and you get 200 replies saying, yeah, I got it. And I'm talking presidents and Hall of Famers and Negro League teammates and childhood buddies. So this is pretty comprehensive because Willie made it so with the access he gave me.
What kind of interviews did you do and sort of what was your process for that?
I wanted to talk with everybody significant in his life or significant in the world. I mean, I spoke with George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and Hank Aaron and Frank Robinson and Joe Morgan, everybody, his Giants teammates, 30-plus Hall of Famers, Bill Greason, who was a rookie with him on the 1948 Birmingham Black Barons. And I wanted to make sure that this book, every quote that you saw in the past, whether it was another book or a magazine or a microfiche or a newspaper, was off limits for this book. I wanted it all to be 100% exclusive, fresh material, and therefore it has zero bibliography. And if you look at other Mays books, sometimes 30, 35 pages of bibliography, which is fine, but I just wanted to make sure that Willie expresses his life in his words now. I don't want other people filling in the blanks for him. And that's why I spoke with so many significant people in his life to supplement his stories. And, you know, that way, you know, 24, his iconic number, we came up with 24 chapters and it could deal with his relationships with Obama or his dad or Barry Bonds or anybody like that, or significant moments. We know about the catch at the Polo Grounds, the four home runs in Milwaukee, the walk-off home run off Warren Spahn in the 16th inning for Marichal to beat him 1-0. But this really digs a little deeper, and there's a how-to chapter on his five chapters. So it's really for kids, it's for adults, it's for anyone in between, it's for old-timers who saw him play, it's for people who wish they saw him play and beyond.
It has great stories. Tell me about how you conducted the interviews with Willie.
Mostly at his house, and we did the math. We probably spent 100 hours plus together for the sake of this project. And I hung out with him in the clubhouse office in his suite above left field at the ballpark, mostly at his home, some at his Scottsdale residence. And all along the way, Willie gave me unbelievable access. Bob Costas interviewed Willie and Hank at NYU the day after the Yankee Stadium All-Star Game. And I was in the green room back with those guys. You know, Dennis Gilbert's annual Scouts dinner in December in Beverly Hills. Willie was honored 1 year and he brought back his remaining surviving Negro League teammates, four of them. And Willie invited me up to his suite with all these legends. And Vin Scully's last call was in San Francisco. And when Willie visited his booth, you know, he made sure I was there with him. So every step along the way, and this goes back 15 years when I first brought this up, he and I'm talking hospitals too, Buster, Stanford Hospital and all these other hospitals that he visits and never publicizes it. No newspapers knew about it. No radio, TV knew about it. It was just, I just shadowed him. And it was just unbelievable stuff, what he does on the side that no one knows about.
Give me an example of a story that he told you that you were absolutely blown away by. Like there was an anecdote that as a writer, you couldn't wait to use it to the point that even as a, you know, because you work in the, of course, for the Chronicle all this time, you're just dying to get it out there.
First of all, Buster, imagine this teenage Willie Mays playing for the Birmingham Black Barons, and right after high school graduation, the Giants assign him to the Trenton Giants of the Class B Interstate League. He goes from a league with all African-Americans to a league with all whites, not only the only African-American on the team, but the entire league. And this was 1950, 3 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. And Willie was hearing a lot of the same things that Jackie was hearing, but this was at the minor league level and some games below the Mason-Dixon line. And this was 1950. He grew up in the Deep South, the Jim Crow era and all that. But now he's playing white baseball as the only black man of color in the entire league. And so he's hearing all these insults. And we were at his house one day. And Buster, he looked at me and told me, he says, "I wondered if it was all worth it." And it gave me chills because I was thinking, what if there was no Willie Mays in Major League Baseball? What if he didn't go on to lead this life he led or this career he played? And it luckily and fortunately for everybody concerned, it was worth it for him. And he didn't let the bigots win. He overcame and persevered and moved on and was better than all of them. And for that, we're very fortunate. But because he grew up in, segregated Birmingham, right outside of Birmingham. And Martin Luther King in the 60s called it the most segregated city in the country. And it's just unbelievable that the time and place he was raised. And then all these years later, he's on Air Force One with President Obama going to St. Louis for the All-Star game. And even he said he was getting chills based on the lifestyle he led and how far America has come. But as we know now, it really has. And as Willie mentions, it hasn't come far enough by any means.
What a crossroad in baseball history that it was possible that he didn't land with the Giants. There was an American League team that had an opportunity to sign him. Can you tell that story?
There was about five or six teams that were on him in 1950 when he was a senior in high school. And Willie talks, the team that was on him the most, that talked about him the most, that had a minor league team playing in Birmingham at the exact site, Rickwood Field, which is still going strong today. It was built in 1910, and it's the oldest existing ballpark in professional baseball, and everyone should go there, by the way. But the Birmingham Barons, the white team, were a minor league outfit of the Boston Red Sox. So they knew about Mays more than any team. And, of course, Yawkey and Joe Cronin, who ran the Red Sox, were not going to have a man of color until 1959, 12 years after Jackie broke the color barrier. But Willie talks now about how it was such a missed opportunity for all these teams. He doesn't regret it because, for him, the Giants made sense. He got to play in New York. He got to play in San Francisco, went back to New York. But yeah, all these teams blew it because he wasn't our type of player. You know what that means? He couldn't hit the curveball. Well, he was 19 years old or 18 years old. Who can against, all these formidable Negro League players who were in their mid 20s or early 30s and every bit as good as many major leaguers. But Willie later said, "Oh, come on, that was my pitch. I could always hit the curveball." So what that meant was all these teams just went through the motions to scout him, but only the Giants got it done.
We're talking with John Shea, the author of the new book, 24 Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid, of course, about Willie Mays. Our good friend Peter Gammons told me a story recently about how Ted Williams said to him, "Can you imagine me and Willie Mays in the same outfield together?" I think he also mentioned Jackie Jensen, right field. That would have been unbelievable. One of the things I really enjoyed in your book was his perspective on Bobby Thompson's home run, which, I mean, I'm better than I do. It was one of the biggest home runs in baseball history. Willie Mays was on deck, and as I read your thing, I burst out laughing because it's exactly what Alex Rodriguez told me last year. This was in advance of Edgar Martinez going to the Hall of Fame. About Edgar's iconic hit in the 95 playoffs when Ken Griffey Jr. races around the bases and he scores, Alex Rodriguez was in the on-deck circle for that one, and he had the same feeling that Willie Mays did in 1951, if you can tell that story.
Well, yeah, Willie was a rookie. And remember, he was called up late in 1951. The Giants broke the color barrier 2 years earlier with Monty Irvin and Hank Thompson. So by the time Willie comes up, they've been integrated for a couple of years. But he's 20 years old, and he's a phenom. And Leo DeRocher stands by him despite the 0-for-12 and the 1-for-20. Struggling early, but Leo said, hey, listen, all we want you to do is play defense. We don't care if you hit. And still, Willie hit some home runs. He got on base. He was great on the bases, and he was great in the outfield. Pitchers loved him. But fast forward to the end of that season when the Giants made this miracle comeback and Bobby Thompson is at the plate. Well, who's on deck? Willie Mays, the 20-year-old kid who says now he was as nervous as heck, but that moment helped him not be nervous in clutch situations down the road. So Bobby hits the home run. Everyone's jumping around the bases and people pouring out of the dugout, and the Dodgers slowly walk back to the clubhouse in center field at the Polo Grounds. That's how it was configured. But you look at the film, there's no Willie Mays. You know, Willie Mays was in the on-deck circle, the shortest distance between anybody and Bobby Thompson coming to the plate. And there's no Willie, because he just said, I stayed there. I was so nervous, I don't know what was going on. And he said, man, luckily I didn't have to hit. He says that now, but at the time he felt that. But, you know, all these years later, those were his moments. You know, give me that opportunity. But it was pretty funny that Willie Mays, who later hit 660 home runs, first ballot Hall of Famer, the greatest overall player in the history of the game, was on deck, but you didn't see him in the film because he was so nervous he didn't even want to do it. He didn't know what was going on, but it was pretty funny the way he describes it.
Yeah, the way he talked about it, as I say, reminds me of Alex saying feeling relief that he didn't have to be in that moment. One of the, you know, the stuff that he told you about when he was traded to the Mets early in the 1972 season, that was fascinating. What the owner, Joan Payson, told him about coming to the Mets and his contract.
Yeah. Well, this is Willie Mays. Remember, in 1971, Willie was 40, and he was very good for a Giants team that won the division, and he was a three-hitter, and he led the league in walks and on-base percentage. He hit 18 home runs. He stole 23 bags out of 26 attempts. He was still very good. So what happens the following May? Well, they trade him. Horace Stoneham says, well, I can't afford his $165,000 salary. Imagine that. So they sent him to the Mets. And yeah, you're right. Joan Payson, who was a minority owner in the old New York Giants and just loved Mays and was depressed for so long that Willie was playing in San Francisco. And years later, she took over majority ownership of the New York Mets, the expansion team, and always had a dream of Willie coming back to New York. So sure enough, she trades for Willie Mays, and Willie plays that 72 season and is in the World Series in 73. But Jones says, hey, we want you here. We want you here long term. And we said, what do you mean? I'm about to retire. He says, no, here's a contract. He says, well, what do you mean a contract? He says, well, she says, write your own contract. I said, what does that mean? So Willie took the paper and says, I, Willie Mays, will do what I want when I want. Signed, Willie Mays. Gave it back to her, said, there's no way she's going to sign it. And Willie says, she signed it. So Willie stayed with the organization for a number of years, and that's how much Joan Payson loved Willie Mays and really all the entire city of New York.
And if Barry Bonds gets into the Hall of Fame one day, a lot of it, I believe, is going to be because of the support from Willie Mays. Can you get sort of detail his feelings on that?
You know, the relationship with Barry Bonds goes back to the relationship with Bobby Bonds. When Willie was finishing his career in the late 60s, early 70s, this kid, Bobby Bonds, came up, who was supposed to be the next Willie Mays. And how much pressure is that on a young kid? It's too much. But he could do everything Willie could do. He was just young. He could run and hit and throw and field and hit for power. And he had more 30-30s than anybody, five of them. And the only guy who has that many also has the last name of Bonds. His name is Barry. So anyway, Willie goes back to the moment shortly before the death of Bobby Bonds, who died of cancer when Barry was still playing. And Willie was at Bobby's deathbed, and Bobby told him, said, listen, you got to take care of Barry because you're the only guy that he'll listen to. and Willie vowed to do that. He promised. So when Barry was going through all that stuff with Belko and the pursuit of the Babe, the pursuit of Hank, who was by his side more than anybody? Well, it was Willie Mays in the clubhouse, off the field, behind closed doors. And it was always somebody that Barry could count on. Now, what that meant was sometimes he traveled, but most of the time it was at home. And I saw Willie Mays sometimes stretch out Barry Bonds in the middle of the Giants clubhouse. Like Bobby's on his back with his legs up and Willie's pushing him and moving them all. And I, this is Willie Mays. So that's how much, you know, Barry meant to him, or Willie meant to Barry. But yeah, you're right. And a couple of years ago when the Giants retired Bonds' 25, which was also worn by Bobby Bonds, Willie Mays was there, and he wasn't supposed to talk, but he got the microphone and spoke for about 10 minutes. And basically, it was a campaign speech for Barry to get in the Hall of Fame. And it was pretty touching, and it went over well in San Francisco. Now, obviously, that stuff doesn't go over well in all cities in baseball, but Bonds still is an icon here because he drew so many people to that ballpark. It's basically the ballpark Barry Bonds built, just like Yankee Stadium was Babe Ruth's name. So anyway, yeah, I think it's a triangle relationship because Barry was like 5 years old and playing around in the clubhouse and followed Willie Mays out to the field when his dad played ball for the Giants. And that relationship really never went away. It was Willie Mays who encouraged young Barry Bonds to go to college because the Giants actually drafted him pretty high. But, you know, negotiations didn't work. So Barry went off to college and then drafted 3 years later by the Pirates and then became a free agent and then signed with the Giants and reunited with his dad, who was the first base coach at the time, and the great Willie Mays.
Well, John, I'm jealous that you get the opportunity to have all those conversations. As I said before, I've always thought of Willie Mays being the greatest player ever. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure, Buster. Thanks a lot.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. First up, our guy Aaron at Aaron San Diego. First of all, he tweeted in saying that he is done teaching for the year, so plenty more Bleacher Tweets from Aaron to come.
Nice.
I'm very excited
about
that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Happy to hear a counter from the players. Seems to me that the number of games is going to be as big of an issue as money, since it has been the base of pay. I see an easy compromise. He's suggesting 82 game season with 50% salary. What do you think, Arbiter Buster Olney?
Aaron, Taylor, I think it's about growing. I mentioned to Eduardo that it's like the owners are saying, okay, here's our pile of cash. That's what you guys can have. If you want to have it over 114 games or 82 or 50 games, that's what we got. That, to me, is the big issue. Are they going to be willing to grow that pile of cash that they've offered the players, or the players in their proposal are saying, no, the pile has to be this big? And it's, the two sides have to find a way to get to the middle. My God, they're so far apart, Taylor, even after this back and forth.
It's so depressing. I mean, I think the NBA on Thursday is going to vote basically, you know, rubber stamp their new plan to get games started.
Right.
It's amazing. And we, to live it kind of like every day, like we do, you know, talking about it, you know, I'm sure you're on the phone all day reporting. I just can't believe that we're in this spot right now. Unbelievable.
No, and that they're not making progress.
Yeah.
You know, that they just keep on talking, but they're not really, they're not moving to the middle at all.
Last one for today. Senior Hendricks at Senior Hendricks writes in, if we don't have baseball season, would you anticipate more or less injuries next year?
I think next year they'll be okay. Like, cause they'll have a regular off season or semi-regular off season to prepare for 2021. It is going to be really interesting to see the number of injuries that we see pop up this year. Cause as I've had this discussion with some folks on the player side, you know, their feeling is that, let's say it's a prospective free agent and it's a shortened season of 50 games, 60 games, 70 games. They're not going to want to risk what's on their resume, which is why, you know, the comparison to, you know, a college junior skipping a bowl game or skipping the combine, they're not going to want to risk that. And they might prefer to just work off their past resume. So I think you're going to see it a higher number of injuries this year. You're going to see a lot of players who, ah, man, that shoulder's not feeling so good. I'm shut down. Or that knee's not feeling so good. I'm going home. I think, and that's why I think the importance of collaboration is going to be such a big deal, because if the players, I think, feel like this is getting rammed down their throats, Taylor, I think that there are going to be a lot of players who, whether openly or subtly, are going to opt out of this thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've been talking about that for a couple weeks now. I mean, that is really fascinating to me. I mean, that's another thing with all these shortened seasons being bandied about. Like, you don't really – you hear a little bit of it, I think, from hockey and basketball. You know, the teams that are – you know, feel like they don't really have a chance at, you know, making whatever version of the postseason they cook up. But this is where the conversation is widespread in baseball, and it'll be fascinating to see how it plays out if we get any games.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, that's it for today. My thanks to Taylor and to John and to Eduardo for stepping in and pinch hitting today. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.